Thanks, Laura.
Yes, thank you. So Duncan asked me to talk a little bit about the plans that the LIGO and Virgo collaborations have for using triggers in the advanced detector era. I thought I would preface this with a little overview of what was done in the past and then move into the future thinking. So let's see. There are several reasons to pursue the connection between a gravitational wave and electromagnetic signatures, mostly because the detectable transients in the LIGO-Virgo bands are all coming from bulk motion of mass on very short timescale, and it's plausible to expect there is emission in other channels, radio, optical, X, and so on. So the sources that we're focusing mostly on are the coalescences of compact objects, so neutron stars and/or black holes, which we can expect are connected to short arc gamma ray bursts, optical kilonovae, or the core collapse of massive stars, which could be connected to the long soft gamma ray burst, core collapse, and the optical supernovae. So there are going to be several talks starting with this afternoon on the astrophysics of this signature, so I won't spend much time on this. I think the audience knows much more on this than I do. I would like to emphasize that the scientific stakes for this are high, but there are also technical challenges, and the two main ones are the fact that the localization for a gravitational wave signature is difficult, and we heard a lot about this from Steve before the coffee break, and also the uncertainty on the relative timing of the gravitational wave and the electromagnetic signature is a challenge that we need to think about. So this plot is meant to summarize what's the sensitivity of initial LIGO and Virgo to generic gravitational wave transients. So we have heard before about the coalescence of neutron stars and black holes, but more in general, this plot kind of summarizes what's the reach of initial LIGO and Virgo in units of gravitational wave energy, assuming that we have a source at the galactic center, and this is a function of the frequency for short signals of generic shapes. So what this plot is meant to emphasize is that if we have a galactic source, we can expect to be able to detect a couple of 10 to the minus 8 solar masses in gravitational wave energy at the most sensitive frequency, which is 150 Hertz. For farther out distances, this scales like the distance square. So for instance, if we're thinking about detecting core collapse supernovae and use numerical simulations, on average, this gives us emission of the order of 10 to the minus 7 solar masses. So we can detect core collapse supernova in the galaxy. There are some calculations that predict higher emission, the most extreme model up to 10 to the minus 2. So in this case, we could constrain models all the way farther up by a few orders of magnitude. If instead we are talking about specific signatures and we can do a match filter search like the one that Steve was talking about earlier, then due to the fact there is stronger gravitational wave emission and the analysis can be more targeted, we can reach out farther for compact binary coalescences than for supernovae, for instance. So while supernovas were limited to the galaxy, for binaries containing neutron stars, initial LIGO is already sensitive up to the 50 megaparsec range. Going up to advanced detector, we can think about scaling out by factor 10 in distances. Okay, the biggest challenge, though, is not so much what's the reach, so which kind of signals could appear in the detector, but how do we deal with the false alarm rates? So these two plots are drawn from two different papers, and they both refer to blind injection challenges, so two cases in which a signal has been put into the data and the pipeline has been run all the way through the end to a yes/no claim or possible claim of detection. So you've already seen this plot. This is from the Big Dog event in the most recent run. So it's an injection of a chirping signal, and Steve has talked to you about how The false alarm rates for this kind of search, which was much filtering, was very low, so one every 7,000 years, accounting for the trials factors, and this would have been declared a detection. In contrast, this is a generic search for any kind of short duration signal. So in this case, we had injected into the data a signed Gaussian signature. So this is a 1/8 of a second window in this little plot over here. And what you see in this plot is the result of how this event shows up in comparison to the background, which is plotted over here, where the background is calculated over an equivalent of 500 years of data taking. So if we don't have a waveform that we can do much filtering against, then we're dealing with a background that's increasing our false alarm rates. And we had Gaussian noise. This would have been a signal with a 1 in 500 years chance to happen. In actuality, this was 1 every 43 years. And once we account for the trials factors, only 1 every 5 years, which means a signal with comparable signal-to-noise ratio, order of 12-15 in both cases, would not have been declared as a detection because it was a 10% probability to get it just out of accidental coincidences. So when we're thinking about an unmodeled search that produces a trigger, we always have to be very mindful of what is false alarm rates, what is significance, and a gravitational wave search by itself may flag these events, but its false alarm rates being still too high to declare a detection. So this is just something to keep in mind for what I'm going to say next. So what's the motivation for a follow-up program in the electromagnetic sector? So we want to be able to catch a possible counterpart. This could be a missed gamma ray burst, an orphan afterglow from an off-axis or a failed gamma ray burst, a kilonova. If we do catch a counterpart, this is going to do a lot for our gravitational wave signals. It would make an event stronger in the sense that it would increase the confidence in the astrophysical origin of the gravitational wave candidate. It would allow us to probably detect weaker gravitational wave events, so increase, lower the false alarm rates, increase the confidence we have in the signal we're detecting. Not only that, but also allow for a more precise localization. Is the event from a host galaxy or outside? Which is the host galaxy? By using the electromagnetic information. Comparison of the gravitational wave and electromagnetic wave, electromagnetic emissions, in terms of strength and the timing of the events, could give insight on the progenitor and the environment physics in the progenitor itself, sorry. So the availability of this complementary information that come from the bulk matter motion versus the electromagnetic wave that comes from afterglows could give us clues to open questions. So on whether compact object mergers are engine for short GRBs, what's the evolution of black holes, could allow to test the gravitational wave, general relativity, by looking at propagation speed and polarization. So there are several open questions that could be addressed. And again, there are several talks coming after that are going to pursue this. The biggest question is the fact that managing the accidental coincidences, so the false alarm rate, requires expertise both from the gravitational wave and the astronomy side. So the key points in a follow-up program is going to be to understand what are the normal populations for similar transients, both in gravitational wave and electromagnetic waves. So we did implement a follow-up program in our most recent run in the 2009-2010 run that we had, the S6, VSR 2 and 3 run. In this run, we had three detectors functioning, so Amford, LIGO, and Virgo. And information of the three detectors was combined to search for transients, both of the compact object type using match filtering and of the unmodeled burst type that I mentioned earlier. The information for the searches was put in a common archive, and then software was run to optimize possible detections for position locations for observation there was a phase of manual event validation, and then information was sent out to partner observatories with which we had a memorandum of understanding. So the latency for this kind of this procedure is listed down here. It took only order of minutes to produce the triggers. The validation of the event took up to 10, 20 minutes, and then the latency for sending out this alert was order of half an hour. These two plots show the kind of localization and sky map that we could obtain with the Big Dog event, with that hardware injection that we mentioned earlier. So as you see over here, this is showing the sky map with the top 1,000 pixels in the sky map that have been reported, covering an area of 129 square degrees. So as you can see, this is an example, like we were talking before, of a fragmented sky map. And out of this one, the regions that were covered is zoomed in over here with where the various telescope observations were done. Now, the way this was done was with the Lumen software that used information from the galaxy catalog to choose where to point the telescopes. So what you see over here is a simulated event, a simulated burst-like event. And these are the sky map. These pixels that are colored over here are locations in a 0.4 by 0.4 degree squares of highest probability. So this red is highest likelihood and blue is lowest. And this was all threshold. And these dots over here represent galaxy positions. So the information on the galaxy location, weighted by blue light luminosity and inversely by the distance, was used to identify where to actually point. So these boxes are where I think QuEST would have pointed, and this was the correct localization of the source. So again, lots of different points over here, different areas, and how to cover this region was the trickiest question to answer. These were the partners that were working with LIGO and Virgo during the 2009-2010 campaign. So it was mostly optical telescopes, but also SWIFTs and LOFAR participated to these low latency efforts. And what you see here is the kind of events, the number of events that were followed up. So optical telescopes received 8 plus 6, so 14 events, alerts, and followed up overall on 9. The SWIFT satellite received and followed up on 2 alerts. The radio interferometers, LOFAR had 5 gravitational wave alerts. And the VLA followed up with a latency of 2 to 5 weeks, only 2 events. Now, what did we do with these images that were collected by the telescope? Well, this is the optical image analysis is something that is still ongoing. So in the 2009-2010 campaign, that work was performed mostly by LIGO Virgo collaborators in a collaboration with partners at telescopes. So for each observatory was kind of a different role. The tricky part was that astronomy skills were needed to identify the transient objects, remove the contaminating events. So there was lots of learning that had to be involved in this. It was a learning process. Overall, the optical false alarm rate depend on the telescope, the image analysis procedure, the source position. So this really highlighted the importance of an old sky survey independent from the gravitational wave triggers. So this was a long process. In the future, having astronomers directly involved in this is going to be essential. Another paper that just went out is on the follow-up that was done by SWIFT. So in this case, there were two analysis teams. One was completely SWIFT, and the other involved LIGO and Virgo as well. There were two events that were followed up. This included one of these two was the Big Dog event itself. In both cases, there were 20 detections by the X-ray analysis, 6800 from the optical UV analysis, but it was all consistent with noise, with the accidental sources. So no single source with significant variability, so no detection. This is a simulation, a Monte Carlo simulation of how the detection efficiency would improve if we had a swift follow-up event versus not. So what you see here is the false alarm probability versus detection efficiency. This is LIGO Virgo by itself. And this is how the curves would change by having a coincident detection with SWIFT. So this is just purely based on increasing the confidence by having an external detection in the X-ray field. Now, that was the past. We're now looking forward at the advanced detector era. So you have already seen these curves in both in Albert's and in Steve's talk. So the various scenarios of operations and how the noise curve is going to go from this to one of these future configurations. And that's upcoming in the next few years. And there is a plan to continue a follow-up program where ideally we would have triggers from the full network of detectors. So this is a scenario that's probably going to be in the 2020s. Collecting gravitational wave data, analyze them, identify trigger, infer the position, select possible event candidates, validate them using the estimated background, and then send out the information to observers, so releasing the trigger information itself. So what are the requirements for this to happen? What are the steps we need to take on the gravitational wave sides to make this happen? So it's going to be important that science runs and downtime are coordinated across the different detectors. So not only LIGO, but also Virgo, and possibly in the future CAGR as well. Have a prompt calibration of data transferring to the computing center. This could stay to be in the latency of the 1 minute. Running the analysis, 3 to 6 minutes. And then mapping out the distribution of the detection stability, assigning a confidence to the trigger, validate it. And this is something that we can work on to remove the human factor, but maybe of the order of a few tenths of minutes still. And then localize the position. So Steve talked about the various scenario. Here, I just wanted to put a little order of magnitude table of what kind of error we can expect. Initially, we're going to have probably only 2 detectors, so we're talking about 1,000 square degrees. 3 detector, we're going to be in the hundreds of square degrees. 4 detectors, tens of square degrees. Some signals will be localized better than others, but this is the order of magnitude. This is a simulation that's done for generic short transients. It's the fraction of the sky with a given 90% confidence area error for transients with signal-to-noise ratio less than 30. So not the very loud, but the ones that are closer to threshold. And you see how if we start from the LIGO M4 Virgo detector network, 3 sites, this is what we can expect, so hundreds of square degrees. And this is going to improve dramatically with adding a 4 detector. With 5 detectors, we will go to the few square degrees error region. Australia, this was done with Australia, but with India, the simulation is consistent. So the communication with the observer, how's that going to work out? Well, this is an ongoing discussion, but so the idea would be to collect event candidate information, what signal type, the significance, the time, the sky map, the estimated physical parameters, put in a standardized format, and then send alert to observers using standard channels, possibly with the prompt alerts and revised information to distribute later as our parameter estimation improves. Now, the LSC and Virgo have committed to a trigger release policy. This is the link if you want to read it yourself. The commitment is to release public alerts in the long run. So in the 2020s, the triggers will be going out. But until the first few gravitational waves are detected, the collaborations would still rather work with partners through memoranda of understanding. This is a snapshot of the text. A couple of things that I've highlighted is that this MOU type of agreements would be open, so open to all requests from interested collaborators. The number of first detector listed here is 4, so after the first 4 events have been found, then we will go into the open release, open trigger distribution. And then throughout the advanced detector era, there will be a release of appropriate segments of data from the operating detectors corresponding to the detected signal, so that data would go out. This is a different way to show the same information on a timeline. This is for LIGO, but similar timeline is expected for Virgo. You know, between now and 2015, we'll be in the detector acceptance mode. Getting to the point where all subsystems are installed, the detector is ready to acquire data. Then there will be the so-called discovery phase. So this period in between that could last for a couple of years. This is where we are expecting to perform all the detector shakedown operation and possibly the first few detection. At this point, the collaboration with partners will be through memorandum of understanding, just because of the level of uncertainties that would go with releasing the detect the triggers and establishing the confidence in an event. After that, in observational phase, significant triggers will be released to the public with a very low latency, those tens of minutes that I talked about before. The full data set would be released to the public with some longer latency and a periodic cadence, so order of 6 months, but those numbers still have question marks on them. This is a snapshot. I think Albert already mentioned this earlier. It's a snapshot of what the full data release could look like. This was done for, this is all data from 2005, around a non-detection, a significant non-detection for GRB051103. And this is the link that you can look at, more meaningful than looking at this slide over here. This page contains links to the data, strain data itself, and calibration information, and so on. So something like this would be done for those 4 detections, but not on a very low latency. So in conclusion, there are strong scientific motivations to pursue a joint analysis in an electromagnetic follow-up of gravitational wave triggers. The challenges have to do in big parts to the ability of localizing the source, having confidence detection, but the program was tested with initial LIGO and Virgo. It was a learning experience. We learned a lot through it, and that's kind of educating how we want to move forward in the advanced detector era. The current thinking is that the advanced detector era, significant triggers will be released with low latency, the full data set with a slower cadence. Early on, the collaboration will be through an agreement, but the broad participation is welcome and encouraged. And so the question is, what would it take for the astronomy community to be interested and involved in working with us from the very early days through this kind of agreement? After the first 4 detection, then it's trigger release in a GCN type style. That's all I had. Thank you.
Okay. Questions for Lara?
Well, I promised Lars I won't be, I'll be positive about the LIGO people. But for you to say the program was successfully tested, I think that's a exaggeration. You took data in 2009, and I believe this is the year 2012. You haven't looked at the data yet. You have no result. This business, either you take data and analyze it in a meaningful way, or you just don't bother.
Well, I say, well, the part that was successful was the release of the trigger, okay, sending the trigger out. It is true that the optical analysis is still in progress. That is a reflection of the fact that it was a learning moment for us. The successful part, I would say, is the release of the trigger. Being able for us to analyze the data and sent out with within minutes triggers. Given in the past, it would take years to get to that point. That was a major improvement for us.
Maybe I can ask a question. So you're saying it was a learning experience. So what were the lessons learned? I mean, it seems to me like one of the lessons is, let the professionals do what they know how to do rather than
right.
try to do it yourself.
Right. So that's what's going to happen after the first four triggers. We are not going to want to be, we don't want to improvise ourselves astronomer anymore.
I think let the professionals handle it is one of the lessons we've learned. Well, I think, but Lara said something which is, you know, we have this limit that basically is being imposed on the LSE of these four triggers, right? But I think before that, we do want professionals working with us and doing that type of analysis. I don't think we want to do it ourselves. At least I don't want to do it myself.
Yeah, I would go even farther than that. It's not that, I mean, even for those first four detection events that are part of this MOU era in the commissioning phase, that I mean the analysis should clearly be done by the astronomers who are taking the data. The MOUs are only there to maintain privacy until the LSE and Virgo figure out whether it was really an event, which involves the checking the detectors that are still being commissioned at that point. So I think the lesson learned was let the professionals do the analysis, definitely.
Hopefully we'll have made detections before we have three detectors anyway.
So I had two questions. One is, has Virgo signed off on the MOU, and what is, what is likely to occur? I mean, obviously they're needed for the localization, which is one of the more important aspects. And my second question is, how flexible is the MOU? So, one of the interesting things with follow-up is you may not know what resources you need.
Right.
And on a very short notice, and so is it the case that someone can sign this and send it in like instantaneously, or does it have to go through some approval process that could take a while?
So first of all, the Virgo parts, Virgo is on board with this policy that they put up there. So that what you see over there has been the result of extensive discussion with our Virgo collaborators, and so that's an agreement that has been reached. This force for detection before the triggers just go out. That's part of what was agreed on with them. You had the second part of the first question? So what we would like to do is to keep this MOU as painless as possible. Maybe a one-page agreement that establishes some confidentiality, you don't want to publish without telling us before. We're going to have to discuss all the detail of this in terms of resources and things like this. I don't think we are that far in that decision making yet. So we would like to keep it as flexible as possible, but at this point it's negotiating.
So it seems that comparing the timeline you had with the first, four triggers in 15, 16, if we're lucky, with what Steve showed earlier, it seems it may not be a problem because the first four may not have any localization
right.
because you have no advanced LIGO, you don't have LIGO India. And so, you need an MOU, but you didn't get too much anyway.
That's right.
And then by 19, it's all open. So it's,
yeah.
So don't worry.
I think the trickiest point there is to decide where to do the pointing. So we're going to have 1,000 square degrees, who points where. I honestly don't know how that choice should be made. So hopefully, there are going to be enough collaborators that agree to work with us, and they can put their inputs in deciding where to point and how to split, and then do the image analysis themselves. Again, where we are stopping at is producing the triggers, and then how the sky map is going to be explored is something where the astronomer should have a say.
Laura?
Oh, okay, hi.
I want to revisit Sri's point. I seem to recall that part of the issue was we couldn't get the astronomers to analyze the images. Was that accurate in my recollection of that?
That was my understanding, although I was not involved in that negotiation, but Peter maybe wants to say something about it.
Well, that I wouldn't make a blanket statement like that. It was different with the different partners we worked with. But certainly when we started, the first one or two partners we approached said, yeah, we'd be happy to collect images. We'll give you our image analysis software. We'll help you learn how to use it. And so we've had students and postdocs who have done that. And in other cases, our partners just went and did the analysis. So it was really a heterogeneous thing. And the best that can be said about it is that we explored many possibilities. So I think we learned from doing that.
I think there's this supposition that just observing the electromagnetic sky in the places where the localization is promulgated will actually lead the world to understand that you have an electromagnetic counterpart. And I think that may not be true in the sense that there may be thousands of transient sources that are unidentified and unknown in any one of these very large error boxes. And what will probably put people over the edge and saying this is the one that's truly the counterpart will be with spectroscopy. And one of my concerns is that the MOUs that have been created so far are largely with the facilities and observatories that have capabilities of essentially just doing imaging. And what I see happening in a potentially bad way might be that there may be many people outside of those MOU observing communities that are sitting on big telescopes on the night when the big one happens, and they won't be able to use the big glass because there isn't a mechanism for doing that. So I think the collaborations in general need to think beyond imaging and need to start thinking about the science. And I think it's not even just, what's this radioactive element in this kilonova, but do we even have the right counterpart? And I guess I'm arguing that you may not, even if you have it in the can, you may not know that you've actually got the right counterpart until you do the next step. And I don't think there's any talk about how you get those sorts of people folded in.
You mentioned that SWIFT looked at two transients. What was the choice of the second transient? The first one, of course, is the false one, but what's the second one?
Yeah, the second one was simply the only other event that passed our criteria. Which was simply having this was a target opportunity type of observation. So we just went for an event that had a relatively low false alarm rates. So this was one every month of coincidence data. So this was out of a month, it was the loudest event. And the requirements that 20% of the sky map was covered by up to no more than 5 tiles in XRT. So basically a minimal requirements on the localization. And that's what this event was sent out. It was just, it was not something we would have declared a detection. It was something consistent with our noise. It was the loudest, and so that's the one that was followed up. So this kind of decision of which events are to be followed up, that's why, once we get to send out triggers, they will come with their false alarm rate, and then it will be up to the observatories to decide whether to follow up on them or not. This was the one we had.
Okay.
I'll just add to what Josh was saying, which it seems like the thread here is to say that there's some lack of confidence in gravitational wave detections only, and the EM side could help that significance. But my worry is that could also lead you astray, right? Because if somebody observes this error region and they say, hey, I think that's the counterpart, and that's not the correct one, then in fact you've not increased your confidence. You've just muddled the picture together, and so. It's not obvious to me that's the way you want to proceed. I think you want to understand the gravitational wave side well enough that you can say we believe that's a detection, whether it has an electromagnetic counterpart or not, because of these challenges of imaging and maybe doing spectroscopy on large numbers of objects.
Yeah, I think the difficult decision is at the moment you do the prompt follow-up, then afterwards there's going to be lots of soul searching on our parts as well as on the astronomy part, I'm assuming. It comes back to this issue that we each have to understand our own faults and we'll be doing our best to to state the best confidence we have in advance. And then it would be the community altogether we have to decide. I think that the idea of this first four events is to kind of understand how to handle that.
I think at least from the compact binary side, we are not relying on EM facilities to help us make the detections of gravitational waves. It's not something, you know, we are proceeding under the assumption that we have gravitational wave detectors, we have gravitational wave observatories, that's how we're going to make our first detections. And we see, you know, EM adds science and adds scope rather than it being essential to make the first detection. Okay, let's thank Laura again. Okay, our next speaker is Stefan Barmer, and we asked Stefan to look a little bit beyond the advanced LIGO era. One of the goals of the program here is to think about what type of science we can do with combined gravitational wave and electromagnetic observations, not just in the advanced LIGO era, but beyond. What happens beyond the second generation directors? Beyond the second generation detectors. You know, what science can we do with advanced LIGO, and what could we do with either upgrades to the existing LIGO facilities or perhaps even a third generation, fourth generation detector like the Einstein telescope, thinking a bit further ahead. So, Stefan?
All right.